Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2. For the record, program number 720, Overview of the Pan-Turkist Movement. This program is being recorded on August 1st of the year 2010. We're going to plunge right back in where we left off, and we have been listening to an excerpt of AFA program number 14, the first of two shows about the former World Anti-Communist League. The material you're about to hear was recorded on January 14th of the year 1986. We were operating from relatively crude cassette recorders, so if the sound is less than optimum, please bear with us. Once again, we're talking about the history of the Pan-Turkist movement, and we're going to resume analyzing many of these same elements and individuals in connection with a variety of recent activities. And in particular, we're going to be taking up names like Ruzina Czar and Theodor Oberlander in connection with our discussion of a very important recent book that I would recommend to the listeners, a book called A Mosque in Munich by Ian Johnson, subtitled Nazis, the CIA, and the Rise of the Muslim Brotherhood in the West. Here, then, is more from AFA program number 14 from January 14th of 1986. In addition to my own voice, you will also hear the voice of my very charming and capable former co-host, Nip Tuck, who assisted me with the on-air responsibilities.
Reading from Galen's Spy of the Century. From such Caucasian defectors was recruited a battalion, codenamed Bergman, or Miner, which grew to comprise three Georgian, one Azerbaijani, and one Armenian company under the command of Captain Theodor Oberlander. Some of these men went into action in October of 1942 at Terek and Mozduk, collecting 1,600 defectors from a Soviet division whose political commissar was Mikhail Suslov. So again, Theodor Oberlander, a key member of WACL, as we're going to look at shortly, was commanding a battalion composed of Turkic defectors fighting now against the USSR. Now, it's worth noting that the nation of Turkey essentially remained neutral, although they were quite sympathetic to the Axis. They remained neutral until the very end of the war when they came in on the side of the Allies. Now, the Pan-Turkist activists were very, very bitter towards the Turkish government. Obviously, they wanted to bring the Turkish nation in on the side of the Axis as a means for assisting the German victory and for partitioning the Eurasian parts of the Soviet Union. Now, the Turkish government was a little more far-sighted than these individuals, and they basically held the rein in on the Pan-Turkists because they were afraid that the Pan-Turkists might eventually bring them into the war against the Soviet Union. Not that they were particularly enamored of the USSR, but they were afraid of it, and they felt that remaining neutral would be a better path for them to pursue in case, as it turned out to be, the USSR won the war, then they would not have an enemy, a huge and powerful enemy on its borders. So because of this reason, because they didn't want to alienate the USSR, and as it turned out that was a far-sighted decision, the Turkish government reins in the Pan-Turkists in Turkey because the Pan-Turkists want to bring Turkey into the war on the side of the Axis. And in 1944, as the military fortunes were turning very obviously against the Germans and the Pan-Turkists felt that their time was running out, a series of demonstrations broke out in Turkey to attempt to prevail the Turks to come in on the side of the Axis. They were put down, and a key name for our purposes was crops up in connection with these demonstrations.
And we're going to be reading from Jacob Landau's book, Pan-Turkism in Turkey. And the name comes up at the very end, so there'll be a lot of other names before then. Reading from Landau's book, open conflict between Pan-Turkists and the government was thus inevitable. Again, Dave just explained why there's conflict between the government and the Pan-Turkists. The government wishing to remain neutral, the Pan-Turkists not wishing to remain neutral. On February 20th and March 21st, 1944, respectively, Atsiz published two open letters to Premier Mehmet Sukru Sarkoglu in his monthly Orhun, denouncing subversive activities in Turkey, chiefly those of communists, and demanding more active Turkist, and by inference, Pan-Turkist policy. Several issues of Orhun were confiscated, and the periodical was subsequently closed down. The Pan-Turkists then took to the streets, crossing the critical threshold between ideological propaganda and political action. On May 3, 1944, in defiance of martial law regulations, large anti-communist demonstrations took place in both Istanbul and Ankara. to protest against what the government, what the demonstrators considered the penetration of communism into Turkey's government bureaucracy and educational system. Pan-Turk slogans were also in evidence, probably inspired by growing anxiety over the fate of Turkic groups in the Soviet Union. The deportation of Tatars and others was then being planned and was in fact carried out a few days later. Such notable pan-Turkists as Atsiz, Turkan, and others were involved, as well as a young captain, Alparslan Turkesh, who was yet to make his mark in Turkish politics. Now, Alparslan Turkesh, along with a lot of other students and folks, were involved in Alparslan Turkesh is a man whose name we are going to hear a lot more of.
Okay, now Alparslan Turkesh is head of the National Action Party, which is, although it is pan-Turkist, it is also extremely fascist and racist in its outlook. The National Action Party is a dominant force in Turkey today, very closely allied with many NATO elements, and of course its youth wing, and it's explicitly fascist now, although it is pan-Turkist. This is this marriage of pan-Turkism and Nazism during the war here is what led to this outlook. Basically, the youth wing of the National Action Party are the Grey Wolves, of which Mehmet Ali Aja is probably the best known member. Now, returning again to Theodor Oberlander, key member of WACL and a fellow who was commanding a battalion composed of Turkic nationals who had been captured by the Germans and reformed into a unit fighting against the Soviet Union. Apparently, definitely, Theodor Oberlander had envisioned the use of the various ethnic nationalities of the Soviet Union as weapons against the Soviet Union and envisioned granting them equal ally status. This was something that most of the Germans did not want to do, and so it actually led to Oberlander's falling out of favor. But Oberlander had keyed the strategy, and this was used by Galen, of utilizing the various ethnic nationalities in the Soviet Union specifically as political allies and to be used in order to break up the USSR and defeat it militarily. I mention this because this is a key element of various aspects of the ABN today, the breakup of the Soviet Union, and the nationalist aspirations of the various ethnic nationalities were to be utilized by Oberlander. Reading from a book called Against Stalin and Hitler, written by a man named Wilfried Strickfeld, and that man is a key Galen aide, by the way. This book was copyright 1970, published in hardcover by the John Day Company. It's sort of a distorted book. It maintains that the Vlasov Army, which fought with Galen against Hitler, was basically also anti-Hitler. It wasn't. Although they weren't enamored of Hitler, they weren't fighting against him. They were fighting against the USSR, so he takes a little bit of leeway here with historical reality. However, the important part here is he describes Oberlander and his philosophy. A proposal of Zeitzler, approved by Hitler, ran, quote, "Locally raised formations are not to be of more than battalion strength. Remuneration should be of some kind or other in money or promises." But at the very moment when Hitler ruled out units of more than one battalion strength, there had come into being the Cossack Division under General von Panwitz, the Russian Defense Corps in Serbia under the emigre General Stefan, and other large formations as well. Professor Oberlander was commanding the so-called Mountaineers Regiment, composed of Caucasians which had served with distinction in the Southern Army Group. This I learned from a memorandum of Oberlander's, a copy of which reached me from the OKW, that's German Military High Command. Oberlander pressed for the setting up of Russian and Ukrainian liberation armies with the status of allies. We've already seen Oberlander working with Turkic nationals and nationalities from the Soviet Union. Now we're going to take a look at Oberlander working with Ukrainians as well.
Okay, this is from a Village Voice article, May 14, 1985, headline Reagan and the War Crimes Lobby. The article is by Joe Connison. He also wrote the first article, along with Murray Wass, that we read tonight on the broadcast. A leading figure among the rightist emigres is, they're talking again about the rightist emigres who are specifically in this case trying to smash the Office of Special Investigations, which is investigating World War II war criminals in the United States, many of whom are Eastern European emigres, many of whom are strongly affiliated with the Reagan administration, as we've been talking about tonight. Among their supporters, not only Ronald Reagan, but his communications director, Pat Buchanan. A leading figure among the rightist emigres is Dr. Lev Dobryansky, Reagan's ambassador to the Bahamas and chairman of the Ukrainian Congress Committee of America, the UCCA, and the Captive Nations Committee, Incorporated. Dobryansky, whose daughter Paula serves on the staff of the National Security Council, is also board chairman of a leading emigre publication, the Ukrainian Quarterly. Another is Yaroslav Stetsko, chairman of the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, the ABN. We've been talking about them a lot tonight. And for a brief period in the summer of 1941, premier of the Independent Republic of the Ukraine. Stetsko, an elder statesman of the international far right, was received at the White House in July 1983 by the President and Vice President George Bush. He and Dobryansky also helped to create the World Anti-Communist League, the organizational haven for neo-Nazis, fascists, and anti-Semitic extremists from two dozen countries, formerly headed by racial theorist Roger Pearson. The spotty history of wartime Ukrainian nationalism is useful in understanding the anti-OSI campaign. OSI, of course, Office of Special Investigations, the people who are trying to deport these war criminals. It's useful in understanding the anti-OSI campaign in which Dobryansky, Stetsko, and their compatriots are implicated. For centuries, the believers in a separate Ukrainian state were frustrated by rulers from without, Polish, German, and Russian, and irritated by the presence on their soil of non-Ukrainians, principally Poles and Jews. These sentiments found expression in a variety of nationalist organizations, but the most important role during the war was played by the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, OUN, a fascistic outfit that freely employed terror and murder in its quest for a racially pure Ukrainian state. By 1940, after Hitler and Stalin divided the Ukraine between them, the OUN had split into two factions. The more active and radical, the OUNB, was identified by the last name of its would-be Führer, Stepan Bandera. His most trusted lieutenant was a young nationalist named Yaroslav Stetsko. Hitler's plan to invade the Soviet Union involved a campaign through the Ukraine, with the promised assistance of the OUN Bandera, whose chief patron in the Nazi regime was the real Führer's racial mentor, Alfred Rosenberg. But there was disagreement among the top Nazi leaders on the, quote, Ukrainian question. Heinrich Himmler and Martin Bormann, for example, insisted that Slavs were Untermenschen, lesser peoples whose only purpose on earth was to serve Aryan masters. To them, no Ukrainian state was tolerable. Rosenberg, himself a Baltic German, was more accommodating, and furthermore saw himself as the satrap of an eastern realm in a, quote, new Europe. OUN Bandera held its first and second congresses under Nazi auspices, and among its resolutions in 1941 was the following, quote, "The Jews in the Soviet Union are the most dependable underpinning of the ruling Bolshevist regime, and an avant-garde of Muscovite imperialism in the Ukraine. The Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists opposes the Jews as a pillar of the Muscovite Bolshevist regime, and at the same time is informing the mass of people that Moscow is the main enemy." Such was the ideological preparation for the Nazi invasion and the Holocaust that came in its wake. Simultaneously, the OUN Bandera was adopted by the Nazi spy apparatus, the Abwehr, to aid in the actual invasion both militarily and for intelligence purposes. Battalions of OUN Bandera volunteers under German command were formed both in occupied Poland, the Nachtigall or Nightingale Division, and in Austria, the Roland Division. Though the surviving adherents of the OUN Bandera deny it, historical evidence shows that the Ukrainian nationalists under Bandera reached for an agreement with the Nazis for the future control of the Ukraine. On June 30, 1941, the Nazi invasion reached Lvov, the capital of the Ukrainian province of Galicia, which was the OUN Bandera stronghold. That same evening, the OUN Bandera leaders who had traveled to Galicia with the Nazis declared a sovereign Ukrainian state, with Yaroslav Stetsko as, quote, premier. The division among the Nazis erupted in reaction to this declaration, and within 10 days Stetsko was placed under honorary arrest by officers of the SS. Although this arrest is now portrayed as severe repression by the OUN Bandera, in fact the Germans treated Bandera and his followers rather well, especially compared to the Jews and other victims of the final solution in Lvov, which was being carried out by Nazi Einsatzgruppen and Ukrainian, quote, militia, including many OUN Bandera men. Indeed, according to Alexander Dalin's authoritative German Rule in Russia, 1941-45, quote, "During the following days of chaos, after the entry into Lvov, it became obvious to the Germans that Bandera's followers, including those in the Noctegal regiment, were displaying considerable initiative, conducting purges and pogroms.
Okay, now, remember the Noctegal regiment, and in particular, note the use of the OUN Bandera and its formation in the SS, along with other elements of the various ethnic nationalities that had aspired to carve up the Soviet Union, including, as we looked at, the Pan-Turkists. Now, recall that in Radio Free America numbers 1 and 2, we took a look at the OUN Bandera, the warfare that they carried on in Eastern Europe under SS auspices. We looked at them at considerable length at the tail end of Radio Free America number 1, and again, looked at the OUN Bandera's role in the SS and how later they jumped to the CIA along with the Galen organization. Now, the head of the Einsatzgruppe Noctgal, basically the Einsatzgruppen were the mobile killing units that followed right behind the regular Wehrmacht units in Germany. They simply dispatched the Jews, communists, and other people that the Nazis wanted to get rid of. Now, the Noctegal regiment composed largely of Ukrainian nationalists and fascists from the OUN Bandera. We'll tell you who was the head of the Einsatzgruppe Noctgal, referring to Theodor Oberlander and his wartime activities. At that time, Dr. Oberlander was an SS officer and a member of the notorious Abwehr. According to Die Zeit of Hamburg, he was an expert, quote, for the treatment of other races, unquote, and the political officer of the Einsatzgruppe Noctegal. Okay, so Oberlander is commander of the Einsatzgruppe Noctegal involving fascist Ukrainians. Oberlander's unit entered Lemberg on June 30th and remained in the city 6 days. According to Reitlinger and other sources, 7,000 people were killed, chiefly between July 2nd and 4th. Oberlander does not deny that he was in Lemberg these days, but says that during his stay, not a single shot was fired. And now, after the close of World War II, let me tell you what I was reading from there. I was reading from a book called The New Germany and the Old Nazis, authored by a man named T.H. Tettens, a German anti-fascist, and it was published in hardcover by Random House Copyright in 1961. That's the section of the book I was just reading from. Let me read you some more, again, from The New Germany and the Old Nazis by T.H. Tettens. After World War II, Dr. Theodor Oberlander went on to become a key cabinet minister under Dr. Adenauer's government. Recall in Radio Free America number 2, we looked at Adenauer's role as a Nazi functionary as the wartime mayor of Cologne. Now, Dr. Theodor Oberlander, SS man, commander of the Einsatzgruppe Noctegal, composed of Ukrainians, the man who worked with the ethnic Turks, goes on to become the cabinet minister for Expelle. Now, in Radio Free America number 2, we looked at how the Expelle office and that ministry in the West German government had basically become a vehicle for the agitation for Nazi expansion and the restoration of the 1937 borders of the Reich. And the Expelle group espoused an expanded Reich which would involve such cities as Warsaw and Prague, a greatly expanded Germany. Theodor Oberlander becomes the head of this particular ministry. We also looked at this ministry in connection with Radio Free America number 11, and we're going to come back to it in Radio Free America number 15, because this group was very much involved with some of the people involved with the assassination of President Kennedy. Dr. Walter Becker is one of the main names, Gerhard Frey another. We looked at that in Radio Free America number 11, the Expelle ministry and its role in the Kennedy assassination. We're going to come back to that in our next program. But again, Oberlander was head of that group, reading from The New Germany and the Old Nazis. Of all his cabinet ministers, the minister for Expelle, Dr. Theodor Oberlander, caused the chancellor most chagrin. As a high Nazi official and officer of the SS, he was Reichsfuhrer of the German alliance in the East, Dr. Oberlander had used the Nazi press to demand the expulsion and extermination of the Slavic peoples and the rapid colonization of the vast conquered territories by the German master race. For years, German Democratic papers had charged Dr. Oberlander with packing the ranks of his ministry with former Nazis. Skipping down, the Ministry for Expelle, once headed by Oberlander, is still known as a haven for former high-ranking Nazis. The personal assistant to the minister is today Dr. Wolfram, a former SS officer. The fanatical race propagandist Werner Wensky, ex-mayor of Lodz, serves as director of a department. Head of the press office, Dr. Schlichter, was a stormtroop leader. So again, Oberlander, head of the Expelle office, that office a key vehicle for not only a refuge for Nazi war criminals, a vehicle for Nazi agitation, connected with the German elements who were coordinating with American fascist elements in the Kennedy assassination. Again, Check that with Radio Free America number 11, Radio Free America 2, with more information about the ex-Philae office, and we're coming back to it in our next show.
Okay, before I read the next segment, let me just mention a couple of things. First off, you're listening to KFJC Los Altos Hills. Also, just to mention to those of you fans of Bill Christman, whose show will be following this broadcast, Bill will be here. He is not late. We are running a bit over, and we are going to be running about another 5, 6, 7 minutes, who knows, past the top of the hour. So Radio Free America, folks, stick with us. We're almost done, and Bill Christman will be coming up for those of you who have tuned in for him. Okay, reading from a manuscript by Peter Dale Scott from the English Department of the University of California at Berkeley. Peter Dale Scott, as Dave, I believe, mentioned earlier in the show, a well-known researcher in the field, a man who has authored many, many well-known articles on such subjects as the Kennedy assassination and other things, has also done a lot of work on the subject matter that we're talking about tonight, namely the World Anti-Communist League, which, of course, winds up to be intimately connected to the Kennedy assassination.
By the way, the name of this manuscript, it's called Government Documents and the JFK Assassination, like the Dallas Conspiracy, available from Tom Davis Books.
Okay, reading from Peter Dale Scott's manuscript. Nelson Bunker Hunt, meanwhile, and of course those of you know this is Hunt of the famous H.L. Hunt family.
Also Hunt of the Wackel Group, and who we've looked at so often.
Nelson Bunker Hunt, meanwhile, had become the Texas representative of a German-based intelligence network, the ICDCC, or International Committee for the Defense of Christian Culture, which paradoxically united many of the CIA's most prominent opponents within the United States. Most notably, China lobbyist General Charles Willoughby, General MacArthur's former G2 in Japan and Korea, with representatives from CIA-sponsored organizations abroad, such as the Ukrainians cultivated by the Galen Organization, parenthetically the folks we've just been talking about. One chairman of the ICDCC, Hermann Punder, was a former Abwehr agent and close ally of Galen's sponsors Konrad Adenauer and Hermann Abs of the Deutsche Bank. Konrad Adenauer, of course, became the Chancellor of Germany after World War II. Hermann Abs of the Deutsche Bank, one of the most important financial wheels in Germany before, during, and after World War II. While a later chairman, Theodor Oberlander, was close to the right-wing German emigre group to whose newspaper, General Walker, spoke by long-distance telephone on November 22, 1963, transmitting the story, accepted by the Warren Report, that Oswald, that's of course Lee Harvey Oswald, had shot at Walker in April of 1963. The ICDCC also appears to have been particularly concerned about the future of Vietnam. Thus, Oberlander represented the ICDCC at the 1966 conference of the Asian People's Anti-Communist League. Again, the APACL we talked about earlier. A pro-GEM group, along with several of GEM's original backers in the United States, notably Father Raymond DeJager of the Free Pacific Association, and such other luminaries as Tom Charles Houston, then the Secretary General of Marvin Liebman's World Youth Crusade for Freedom, and later, after a two-year stint in Army Intelligence, the author of the White House Houston Plan. And by the way, the Houston Plan, authored in the Nixon White House, was so absolutely repressive and so absolutely flouting of conventional constitutional rights that Nixon had to tear it up, although, of course, the actual things that were written into the plan went on anyway, and some of them wound up being Watergate.
Okay, now, note in that passage that Theodor Oberlander, the Adenauer Minister for Ex-Belays, is involved with this ICDCC with two of the key names we looked at before in Aryan Nations, Charles Willoughby, the German-born MacArthur intelligence chief, and also Bunker Hunt, Key Bircher, member of the Hunt family, and participant in the JFK assassination, as we looked at in Radio Free America number 11. These guys combining with Theodor Oberlander in the ICDCC. Just to show you how some of these elements are continuous to the present day, the following article comes from the Arizona Republic, research credit to Ted Rubenstein. This from the Arizona Republic of January 30th, 1983. It's a story headlined, CIA allegedly has data on Pope attacker. This is by Robert D. Kaplan of the Cox News Service, Dateline Ankara. This country's most respected authority on terrorism said in an interview that the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency had its own agent, an ethnic Turk born in the Soviet Union, working immediately with right-wing Turkish militants close to gunman Mehmet Ali Aja, who was convicted in the 1981 shooting of Pope John Paul II. Ugur Mumcu, an author, journalist, and former law professor, said Ruzi Nazar, R-U-Z-I-N-A-Z-A-R, a Turk who defected from the Soviet Army in World War II and was recruited by the CIA after the war, was successful in penetrating Turkish fascist circles in the days when Aja worked as a hired gun for the National Movement Party, a leading right-wing organization. Mumchu said that Nazar, a man now about 60, was born near Tashkent in Soviet Turkestan and is believed to be living in Bonn, West Germany with his West German wife. According to Mumchu, Nazar is retired from active service with the CIA. Although the CIA and the U.S. government are saying nothing for many obvious reasons, the CIA absolutely has to know things about Aja of its own accord, which nobody else knows, Mumchu said. Concerning Nazar's ties with Turkish right-wing circles, Mumchu said, quote, in a letter to MHP, National Movement Party leader Alparslan Türkeş, that's the fellow we looked at in the 1944 pro-German demonstrations, a letter that I have seen, a friend of Nazar, Enver Altalay, wrote about Nazar's influence in right-wing Turkish student groups in West Germany. Mumchu said Nazar's CIA links have been verified by a Turkish general who maintained close contact with Nazar. Nazar was in close contact with the MHP leader at the same time that Aja and Musa Serdar Celebi were, Mumchu said. So, according to the top Turkish expert on terrorism, an ethnic Turk born in the Soviet Union, captured by the Germans, who then fought against the Soviet Union during World War II as one of these Turks who fought with the Wehrmacht, then jumps to CIA after the war, is apparently very close to Alparslan Türkeş, head of the fascist National Action Party, and again a man, as we saw, who was arrested in 1944 while attempting to persuade Turkey to come into the war on the side of Germany. And to show you just what Ruzi Nazar is doing today, Nip Tuck is going to read you a short section from a new Village Voice.
Just this short section? This one here? Yeah. Okay,
unless
good.
You want to read the rest of it there.
I think time-wise we can probably get back to that other stuff later, and we've talked about a lot of it. Let me just read you a very short segment from this Village Voice article for the newspaper week of December 31st, 1985. We've mentioned this article before. It's an excellent article on some of the latest developments on the assassination of the Pope and the beginnings of the crumbling of the Bulgarian story and the revealing of the stuff that we've been talking about all along, which is the involvement of numerous right-wing groups in this attempt on the life of the Pope back in 1981. Anyway, just a short segment to let you know one of the things that Ruzi Nazar, who Dave was just reading you about, is up to these days. Friend and colleague of many of Mehmet Ali Aja, the would-be assassin's friends and colleagues. Again, reading from the Village Voice article by Martin Lee and Kevin Coogan from the December 31st, 1985 issue. Again, speaking of Ruzi Nazar, the gentleman that Dave was reading about. Ruzi Nazar, a friend of National Action Party Chief Colonel Alparslan Türkeş, continues to play a leading role in the ABN. This September, Nazar represented the ABN at the World Anti-Communist League Convention in Dallas. So, wackle delegate Ruzi Nazar, intimate of the circle surrounding Mehmet Ali Aja.
That again from AFA program number 14, recorded on January 14th of the year 1986. Now, we have been taking a look at the history of the Pan-Turkist movement because we're going to be taking a look at areas of overlap between Third Reich and Western Cold War geopolitics, and not only the Islamist movement, but also the Pan-Turkist movement. And we're going to be taking a look at some interesting developments vis-a-vis Turkish domestic policy in connection with the recent flotilla situation. And once again, let me recommend emphatically the book A Mosque in Munich, authored by Ian Johnson. It's a flawed book, but a very important book and a must-read for contemporary analysts of the current political situation. Please utilize the Spitfire website, spitfirelist.com. It has all of my life's work available for download for free. There's a mini-library of old anti-fascist books, a cornucopia of anti-fascist information. There's also a page to click on to support the work that I'm doing. And if you don't like what's going on in the world, there's no better way of fighting back than supporting the work that I'm doing. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 720, Overview of the Pan-Turkist Movement. This program is being recorded on August 1st of the year 2010. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.